Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I am here on behalf of Adam Watkins, who is convicted of robbery in the Superior Court, Newcastle County. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm not the attorney who should be arguing this case. The attorney who should be arguing this case would be Carl Schnee, because but for the serendipity of another man coming forward during the trial of Carl's client to confess to the robberies that Carl's client was charged with, Carl might have been arguing to this court back in 1981 that the exclusion at trial of proffered defense evidence that another man bearing a resemblance to Carl's client was suspected of committing similar robberies was an abuse of discretion, despite the Superior Court's finding that the other robberies were attenuated and not similar enough.
Is that the gentleman bandit?
Yes, sir.
Was there a reported decision as a result of that?
Fortunately for Carl's client, there wasn't a reported criminal decision, but there was, however, a civil decision, Pagano versus Hadley in the United States District Court, and reviewed in the Third Circuit, a civil action.
And do any of these reported cases describe what you just related?
Yes, they do. In fact, the similarities between the cases are striking, as in some respects. Some of the nitty-gritty details, and I recall Carl could have faced a situation where, but for that Mr. Clouser coming forward and confessing to the crimes alleged against Father Pagano, the Superior Court conceivably, like the Superior Court did in this case, the Superior Court conceivably there could have ruled that the other crimes evidence for which the police suspected Mr. Clouser committed, as the other robberies, those other crimes were attenuated and dissimilar to the crimes for which.
Help me understand exactly the evidence that you wanted to present, and in doing that, I want you to distinguish the Kaiser case, which the state put in its answering brief and then you addressed in your reply brief. In Kaiser, they wanted to put someone on the stand, the brother, who resembled the defendant. But the brother said he was going to invoke the Fifth Amendment, and the court said there were already photographs of the brother in evidence anyway. We're not going to put the brother on the stand to invoke the Fifth Amendment. This alternative suspect that you describe in your case pled guilty to the other bank robbery. So the record says he didn't know why he was at trial, but the record also seems silent on whether he would invoke the Fifth Amendment. So let's assume he would not, but put that aside. My question is, did you have an independent way to get the video of the other bank robberies into evidence? And was that a request to put the videos of the other robbery in evidence? Or were you going to do it all as part of having this defendant on the stand? And if you couldn't put the defendant on the stand, could you still get the video in? In other words, what's the evidentiary ruling before us? And it seems that putting the person on the stand is one issue. Putting the videotape of the other robbery is a secondary issue, or a second issue, not secondary.
Well, Kaiser can be distinguished because here, Mr. Hurley, you know, the head snapper he promised was not putting Mr. Blevins on the stand, even to deny that he had committed this other robbery or confess he had committed. That was irrelevant to Mr. Hurley's goal. Mr. Hurley could have accomplished all he needed to accomplish by simply showing this other person to the jury as a living exhibit, as more or less, just like the trial judge took a look at him at the entrance to the courtroom doors. That's all the jury needed to see. And then Mr. Hurley could have introduced the adjudicative facts of the guilty pleas as involving that person to the other nearby, says robbery. And he could have done all that, and there's no evidence that he intended to do more than that by simply presenting the adjudicative facts and presenting the defendant and the photographs of the still photographs of the defendant committing the robbery at the Artisans Bank across the street.
Well, what would have been proper argument to the jury from those two facts, that seated in the witness chair before you is someone who looks similar to the defendant, and this person's been convicted of a robbery of a bank? What's the next step that the trial judge would have allowed him to say to the jury if there had been an objection?
Ladies and gentlemen, says my client is accused of committing, says the robbery at the PNC Bank at Limestone Road, says in Kirkwood Highway, across the street a month ago, and we submit there's a remarkable resemblance between the man who is alleged to and pleaded guilty to committing that robbery and my client, who is accused of committing the robbery about which you are weighing his guilt. Look at the photos of those two persons. Ask yourself if this could be the same as person. If that is the same.
Wasn't there something more? Was there at least a proffer that both robbers fled into the same neighborhood, same direction?
Yes, there was. Yes, there were similarities between the two offenses. There were dissimilarities between the two offenses, just as in Pagano. But the point is that the trial court isn't supposed to weigh that under our system, which is what happened here. The jury is supposed to balance that fact-finding. And the problem here is that the trial court put the scales for weighing the evidence into the cabinet and then let the jury exercise it.
Well,
that's the problem here.
We often hear that the trial judge is a gatekeeper. When the trial judge used the term attenuated, while I can grasp the dictionary definition of attenuated well enough, I think, was he really saying that this is a 403 analysis and there's just not enough? There are not enough facts to make this relevant to the issue the jury has to decide. There's a huge difference between robbing a bank and then demanding at an ATM outside a bank that a customer turn over cash to you. And he looked at the photograph and said, well, there's an arguable similarity. It's really not that close. Now, he's acting as a gatekeeper in a 403 analysis sense. Did he actually do a 403 analysis or a 404 analysis? Did he articulate how he reached the conclusion that these facts were attenuated?
In effect, he did. And for all kinds of reasons, that was an abuse of discretion. Just, number one, the trial judge weighed the similarities and dissimilarities, which the jury says is supposed to do. Insofar as if there's conceivable prejudice under 403, the cases that we rely on, and that the state really doesn't dispute, point out that the 403 analysis is improper, says, in this context, because the prosecution is never prejudiced under these circumstances where incriminating evidence is introduced against the defendant.
Didn't we specifically hold in Kaiser that when mistaken identification is the issue, this is not what you use 403 for, because this is the type of confusion that is permissible when the defense is mistaken identification? So we held in Kaiser, this isn't how you use 403, didn't we?
I believe says that's correct, and that is because the defendant has a constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment to present exculpatory evidence. Even with arguably, you know, that it's arguably marginal or arguably relevant, whereas the prosecution doesn't have a constitutional right to present marginally relevant evidence, and that may be excluded under 404B and 403.
But does the record reflect that anybody cited Kaiser to the Superior Court?
No, I don't believe there was a cite to Kaiser. This was Now, the discussion was all on the facts, and essentially the trial court has weighed the evidence before the jury got an opportunity to. That's the problem here.
Was and there any other evidence about Blevins or another possible suspect that was presented?
There was later on in a motion for a new trial, but, you know, we're not raising that here. The motion for a new trial, the burden on appeal here on a motion for a new trial, the scope of review is tougher for the defense, and based upon the facts that we looked at, that's a weaker argument. And, you know, we're not arguing that other evidence. We're arguing this evidence. The jury didn't get an opportunity to consider this evidence, and that's the problem. And it wouldn't have been time-consuming. It would have taken a few minutes at most probably to do what's evident that Mr. Hurley intended to do. Mr. Hurley doesn't waste time at trial. It wouldn't be an all-day affair. It wouldn't be a huge mini-trial. Most of the facts were adjudicative facts, and it would be a presentation of a live exhibit. And then Mr. Hurley's argument is in closing, which he was deprived of delivering to the jury, as he had promised.
But as to the specific proffer, I mean, it's one thing, let's assume Blevins was called and he testifies and he explains that he pled guilty to the robbery of the other bank. And then the $64,000 question is asked. Did you commit the robbery with which Watkins is charged? And Mr. Hurley proffered that his answer would have been no, rather than I plead the fifth. Is that accurate?
Either way, our contention is it wouldn't have made a difference.
Well, it doesn't make a difference if he pleads the fifth, because there's no way to cross-examine, and that's an improper practice, at least recognized in Banther, to call a witness that you know is going to take the Fifth Amendment.
Well, if Mr. Hurley had been presented to go up to that point with a witness on the stand and actually examine that witness and ask him that question, and the trial court excluded after objection of the state, we'd have a different question than we have here this morning.
Well, for the purposes of our review, are we to assume that the witness would have invoked the Fifth Amendment or would not have invoked the Fifth Amendment?
I don't believe it is dispositive one way or another to this issue.
Well, let's assume that at least one of us considers it worth looking into. And what is the record show, that he would or would not have invoked the Fifth Amendment?
I don't think the record shows either. He didn't get to that point.
Well, you can see how it relates to my earlier question, though, because if you really want to get evidence before the jury that there was another robbery with a perpetrator that looks similar, the question is, how do you get that before the jury? And in Kaiser, they got it before the jury with photographs. Mm-hmm. Here you could do it by having photographs or a video of the other robbery. But the defense wanted to put on the witness. And in Kaiser, when you want to put on a witness to show similarity, knowing the witness is going to take the fifth, our court held it was proper not to call the witness because there's other evidence that can come in without this Fifth Amendment issue. That's why I'm trying to get really focused on the evidence that the defense had and how it wanted to present it, and assume there are two of us that are concerned about this Fifth Amendment issue. Does the record allow us to say the evidence of the other robbery and the similarity of the perpetrator should have come in independent of this live testimony?
Yes, because Mr. Hurley could have simply, for all we know, Detective Godek could have been the same investigator on the robberies as across the street. And Detective Godek, in his testimony, could have been asked a few simple facts. Now, wasn't there a robbery the month before at the bank across the street, says the Artisans Bank? And wasn't it? And you arrested someone, says, for that, says, didn't you? And either asked Detective Godek or a court clerk or somebody to present the adjudicative facts that the person you arrested pleaded guilty to robbery, he says, didn't he? And then you don't even have to put the robber on the stand. Now, the person that you arrested and was convicted, sitting, says in the spectator's gallery, says there, is that the person, says, you arrested? And the jury could have looked at that person and compared that person with the defendant. You don't get near, says the Fifth Amendment exercise of privilege. The problem is Mr. Hurley never got to that point. He was hobbled in the gate. He never got out of the gate. That's the problem.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. I have it pleased the court. Well, maybe Mr. Hurley should have wasted a little more time and prepared a proper proffer. Mr. Hurley brought in Mr. Blevins, who had pleaded guilty approximately 5 weeks before trial in November of 2009. Trial was in January 2010. He hadn't been sentenced yet. He was obviously represented by an attorney. He obviously hadn't talked to his attorney because when the judge asked him what he was doing here, Mr. Blevins answered, I have no idea. All we know is that, according to the court records, he had pleaded guilty to a bank robbery that had occurred across the road from place where Mrs. Santana had been robbed at the PNC ATM. And beyond that, we don't know anything about that Artisans Bank robbery that Mr. Blevins had pleaded guilty to. Presumably, if the judge, if he had got this far, would have insisted that Mr. Blevins' attorney would have come in, and I'm assuming his assistant public defender would have advised him to take the Fifth Amendment and answer no questions. Mrs. Santana robbery, but not about the Artisans robbery either, because he hadn't been sentenced yet, and he could still move to withdraw his guilty plea. I have no idea what the plea agreement said. It may have put an affirmative duty upon Mr. Blevins to testify truthfully at some other trial. The state may have moved if Mr. Blevins had violated the plea agreement to withdraw the plea. So certainly I believe if I had been his attorney, I would have advised him not to testify, take the Fifth Amendment, and when asked about either of the robberies. Now, Mr. Hurley had not brought in another witness, and I think this is important in the Kaiser case, where the defense had three witnesses. The defendant's mother, who was going to testify of two incidents where the defendant, charged in the Kaiser case, had been apprehended by the police, who confused him with his brother. Now, that is, it seems to me, very pertinent evidence on this issue of misidentification, and that included police agency, Troop 3, that had arrested him for this crime. And the second witness, this court held as to the mother, this was obviously relevant evidence on the issue of misidentification, and the second witness was a bailiff who would testify that family court, for reasons that are not clear, had issued a capias for one while it should have issued a capias for the other, had confused the two in issuing the capias, although it's not clear. This court said that the bailiff's testimony was marginally relevant, especially when considered placed together with the mother's testimony. And as far as putting the brother on the witness stand just to be there and invoke his Fifth Amendment rights, this court affirmed the trial judge's decision to exclude that evidence. The court reversed Kaiser because the judge had also excluded the other two witnesses.
But with regard to the brother, the court also said there were two photographs of the brother already in evidence.
There were two photographs in evidence, and in a footnote, the court suggested another procedure that could have been, since he had third-party witnesses like the mother, we could have had the brother seated in the audience and have put the mother on the witness stand simply to identify the brother in the gallery. But Mr. Hurley here had no third-party witnesses whatsoever. He had the bare bones of the facts of the Artisans Bank robbery, which, as the judge said, was not particularly similar in any way, except for location,
Well, we do have a proffer from Mr. Hurley, or Hurley, rather, that the Mr. Blevins is going to deny committing the robbery that Watkins was charged. Wasn't that proffer made?
Yes. Mr. Hurley said.
That's not the same as invoking the Fifth Amendment, is it?
No, it's not, but Mr. Hurley had not talked to Mr. Blevins, so, and I'm assuming that if Mr. Blevins, well, I'm certain Mr. Blevins would have talked to his attorney before the judge allowed him to testify, and I am equally certain his attorney would have told him to invoke the Fifth Amendment. Now,
well, he was president in the courtroom without his attorney, wasn't he?
He would, yes, the attorney wasn't there. Excuse Mr. Blevins, the attorney, Mr. Blevins' attorney was not there.
No, that's my point. You said you're certain he would have talked to his attorney. How can you be certain of that when he's in the courtroom but his attorney's not there with him?
Because I don't believe the judge would have allowed him to take the witness stand without consulting with his attorney. I mean,
you don't have any record evidence that would suggest that Blevins independently would have talked to his attorney before taking the stand.
Mr. Blevins hadn't been consulted on this at all.
Your certainty derives from your certainty that the judge wouldn't have let him testify unless he had been satisfied he talked to the attorney first.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In terms of evaluating the legal ruling of the trial judge, the factual predicate for that ruling is what's in the record.
Yes.
Including the proffer that Blevins would take the stand, presumably admit pleading guilty to the other robbery and deny committing this robbery.
The judge looked at the in Kaiser, this court starts out with what's usually called the Getz analysis, the relevancy consisting of both material.
Help me understand, is that the factual predicate for the legal ruling that was made?
That was the proffer that was made, and Mr. Hurley also gave the judge some of the facts of the earlier Blevins robbery, the Artisan's Bank robbery. That was proffered also, and the judge considered that it occurred at a bank in the nearby location. It had happened 6 weeks.
In the absence of an expanded record by the trial judge saying, call the witness, let's hear what he has to say, and then I'll evaluate whether he can do this, don't we just, we can't assume that he's going to take the Fifth, can we? Can we assume that he's going to talk to a lawyer? Can we make these assumptions that they may be logical, but that it's not in the record?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. However, and the judge never actually got that far because the judge based his ruling on the probative value of the proffer, the very first step here.
And we addressed that in Kaiser. In Kaiser, we said, when misidentification is an issue, this is not the way to do the 403 analysis. So we said that in Kaiser. Now, in this case, what they wanted to show was a bank robbery in the same general area within a few weeks where the perpetrator ran into the same neighborhood. Why isn't that admissible evidence?
Because it's not relevant. As the judge went through, he said, one is a bank robbery. It's in the daytime. No weapon was displayed. And the perpetrator handed a demand note. And the other is a robbery of an individual at nighttime in which a handgun is displayed.
Now, I understand that distinction. But what the defendant was saying is, someone who looked like my client committed a bank robbery within the same general area, within the same general time frame, ran away into the same neighborhood. And while the crimes might have only general similarities, their descriptions are strikingly similar. So the focus is on misidentification, not the nature of the crime. And the judge in ruling said, you know, some people may think they're similar. And isn't that what the defendant wanted to get before the jury?
Well, the judge said, I'm not going to rule on that particular issue. I don't know if the judge felt they were the looks were similar or not. The judge said, look, that's not my call. I'm not going to say they're similar.
He said it was. He said it's a subjective determination.
Subjective, but they're in the ballpark. They're both white males and both roughly the same height and weight, I guess. But they're both white males on the young side. Beyond that, the judge would not go. The judge based his decision on the facts of the proffer of the Artisan's Bank robbery and the facts as the judge knew them from the testimony of Ms. Santana as to the robbery at the ATM. Because of these are, as the judge said, they're comparing apples and oranges. The two are not similar at all. Contrast that with the proffer in the Kaiser case, where the defendant's mother is going to testify specifically about two occasions when the police confused the two, the defendant in the Kaiser case and his brother. I mean, that is...
What's confusing to me, anyway, is it seems like there are two parallel analyses going on here. One is the assumption that it's only admissible if there's evidence of an earlier crime with the same scenario as the current crime for which the defendant is charged. That's almost like your Getz issue, that is it not a good idea to allow a jury to infer that a crime that's similar to the crime for which someone's on trial means the same person would have done it. And then the second analysis is the question solely focused on whether or not these two people looked alike, and whether or not, given the occurrence of an earlier crime, however similar or dissimilar, it was fair to allow a defendant to create a question of reasonable doubt in the mind of the jury by allowing the jury to see this person who has been convicted of a robbery. It looks like somehow those issues got blended into one, and the trial judge stopped after saying, look, what this is really about is allowing the jury to infer that a robbery so different than the one for which the person's on trial today could have been committed by the same person. And that's so attenuated from the real issue here, which is whether the ATM robbery took place, that I'm not going to allow the jury to even consider it. Now, I'm not going to be honest with you. I'm having trouble sorting through how that should be handled. What's your view of how a trial judge should handle that situation? We know what Kaiser says about the sensitivity to misidentification. It's not a pure 403 analysis. We know what Getz says about the dangers of inferring that because a crime was committed similar to a secondary crime that the same person probably did both. How do we put that all together and make sense of it while understanding we don't want the jury to speculate about results, but on the other hand, we have to assure that a defendant gets a fair opportunity to create a reasonable doubt in the mind of the jury? I'm sorry that's so long and sounds less like a question than a diatribe, but I'm really at my wit's end in this case.
Yeah. Well, as the judge, as I said, took a hands-off when it came to, I'm not going to look at these two people and say whether they're similar or not. Now, of course, one could imagine a scenario, for example, where there's a distinctive scar, for example, or a tattoo or something like that, where that's going to be the evidence, primary evidence of similarity, something unique like that. So I disagree with the trial judge in saying I'm not going to consider physical similarity at all. I mean, there were some physical similarity. I mean, they're both white, they're both male. Presumably, they're both somewhere in the ballpark as height and weight. One was not skinny, the other morbidly obese. One was not 6'5", while the other was 5'2", something like that. I mean, they're in the ballpark of area, but the judge just took the hands-off approach as to I'm not going to subject base this on my subjective view of how similar these people are. I'm going to look at the objective facts that I have of the two incidents, the bank robbery versus this, and base my decision on that. And that's what the judge did base his decision on, that the two were not similar.
So by his ruling, do you agree then that the trial judge, by his ruling, precluded other evidence, assuming it would exist, that Kaiser would allow, calling the police officer to explain about the other robbery, showing a mugshot of Blevins, and making it other than the presentation other than by calling Blevins to the witness stand.
Yeah.
Did the trial judge preclude that evidence?
Well, in this case, I would have to say yes, but that evidence was never proffered, so the judge never really considered it.
You say yes, I suspect, because the judge's initial view on those two lines of analysis that I was thinking about was that because the robberies are so dissimilar, one's attenuated from the other, therefore you don't get into an issue about a possible misidentification.
Right.
It's almost as if the first threshold is the robberies have to be similar in order to introduce any aspect of a misidentification.
I have to just fall back and say the judge is basing his decision on what was proffered. He didn't have a police officer, for example, to talk about similarities that maybe are not apparent from the bare-bone facts. What he had was simply the defendant and the bare-bone facts of the two robberies. One was a daylight bank robbery 6 weeks before, and the other we know about through the testimony of Mrs. Santana.
Yeah, so let me try the Chief Justice's question just a little differently. Based on these bare-bones facts, the trial judge appears to have said, these crimes are so dissimilar,
yes,
that even if the perpetrator and the defendant look alike, I'm not letting these other crimes in because the predicate for getting the comparison of their appearance doesn't exist unless you can show me the crimes are similar. So it was the dissimilarity between the crimes that was the dispositive ruling.
Yes, that's right, because that's what the judge had to go on. The other cases, the cases relied upon by the trial judge in his final order, March order, and the cases cited by Mr. O'Donnell in his reply brief, all talk about as far as the quantum of evidence. There has to be something other than mere suspicion or a bare possibility that this other person committed the crime. Again, I go back to Kaiser as an example of the kinds of evidence that is admissible as on the issue of misidentification. Notice sort of a sliding scale there with Mrs. Kaiser, the mother, having excellent evidence, the bailiff, well, it will let it in because of the very good evidence of the mother. So there is a sliding scale. But based upon the proffer, the judge did rule that the two crimes were simply so dissimilar that he was not going to allow, based on probability value, that any evidence being put before the jury on the issue of the artisan bank robbery was not probative of the robbery of Mr. Santana 6 weeks later. My time is about up. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Besides the details, I think the question here that I'd like to pose in my own mind, is it impossible under this scenario at trial, is it impossible that a juror might have had a reasonable doubt if Mr. Hurley had been able to present the minimal evidence that we claim he was entitled to present? That's the ball game here. And unless we submit that, unless the court can say that it's impossible that this evidence would have had, that he should have been able to present, the minimal evidence that he should have been able to present, it's impossible that it could have had any effect on one juror to find that there was reasonable doubt, then the trial court erred because the jury gets to make those decisions.
I thought the ball game here was, if we go to Mr. Donovan's point, the similarity of the crimes. And that your argument is, if we're talking about apples and apples, we have bank robbery and bank robbery. We have some time and time connection. We have a connection between the areas where the bank robberies occurred, and we have the perpetrators going into the same neighborhood. Now, if you take those basics, and eliminate the details of how they asked for the money, you've got enough to say, if you've got two banks in the same neighborhood robbed about the same time with people running off in the same direction, that's enough for the jury to be able to decide if the two people look alike, whether or not when they went to ask for the money, they asked for the money in the same way.
We believe that's so. What is wrong with letting, says the jury, decide that? And insofar as for the trial court referred to that, the trial court said to Mr. Hurley, says, now, Mr. Hurley, says, you're talking, what we have here is apples and oranges, and you're talking about fruit. And the way I look at it, it's kind of like Jeopardy. The answer is, what's the question? Now, if the question is, what is red or what is orange, we know what the answer should be. On the other hand, if the question is, what grows on a tree and is good for you to eat? Fruit is an answer. And the question here was whether this other person could have been conceivably committed this robbery and whether there was mistaken identification. It's similar to Pagano. It's strikingly similar to Pagano. Pagano was a controversial outcome. In Pagano, the investigators and state police were extremely unhappy with the Department of Justice for Nolly Prossings as the case is in the middle of trial. They claimed that there was a different modus operandi from the trials in which Mr. Clouser was suspected to have committed, that those robberies occurred in North Wilmington. The robberies that they accused Mr. Pagano of committing occurred in the Kirkwood Highway corridor. So they pointed to a number of dissimilarities, but yet claiming that there was a different modus operandi. Now, it depends upon the question. Must there be identical similarity? Must they be signature crimes in order for the Sixth Amendment to have any utility? It says to a defendant, we submit not. If the court has no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.